Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the British Institute for the Study of Iraq. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Eleanor Robson. I'm the chair of the Governing Council. Delighted to welcome everyone here, many familiar faces, many who I don't know yet, but I hope you'll introduce yourself afterwards in the reception. This tends to be a rather warm room in the in summer evenings. I'm either too close or too far, aren't I? This tends to be a rather warm room in summer evenings, so do feel free to, within the bounds of propriety, take layers off as you need. Before I introduce this evening's main attraction, I have some announcements to make. First of all, I'm delighted to announce the long-awaited publication of the second volume of Samara Studies by Alistair Northedge and Derek Kennett. There'll be flyers at the reception, three enormous volumes for only £64 for members and attendees of the meeting. Pick up a leaflet there. So if you're interested in the archaeology of early Islam, this is one of the most extraordinary, pristine sites of the medieval Middle East. Secondly, a slightly cheaper publication. The latest edition of the Middle East in London is on Iraq, people and heritage, with many articles by BISI Council members. It's available to members and to attendees of the meeting for only £3 instead of the cover price, £4. And again, details of how to get your discount copy will be available at the reception. The third thing is cheaper still, it's free, or at the most, it's the cost of a stamp. As many of you know, the British Institute of the Study of Iraq works very closely with the cultural heritage organisation Blue Shield to campaign for the UK government to ratify the 1954 Hague Convention on the Protection of Cultural Property in the Event of Armed Conflict. Now, what this does, as you can imagine, is bind countries who have ratified the agreement to plan for and carry out protection of cultural heritage sites and buildings while they are engaged in conflict. That may be churches and mosques, it may be libraries and archives, it may be buildings or sites such as archaeological sites that local communities have identified as being culturally important to themselves. Now, the UK is the only member of NATO, the only permanent member of the UN Security Council who hasn't yet ratified. Meanwhile, it's been telling us and Blue Shield since 2005, that yes, of course, it's a lovely thing and they would love to ratify, but if only they could have parliamentary time to do so, both Labour and Conservative and coalition governments. How much parliamentary time? 4 to 8 hours, really very little. So if you haven't done so already, I would urge you to spend half an hour writing to your MP, whether a good old-fashioned letter or an email. And if you go to the BISI website or our blog, you'll find detailed instructions on how to do this, or you can just simply cut and paste the template letter that's been drawn up and send that to your MP. We've already had the support of Philip Hammond, the Foreign Office Minister. We've been in contact with 50 or 60 MPs directly, but that leaves nearly 600 still to contact. So I'm sure amongst those nearly 600 are your constituency MPs. So do what you can for that. Just spend half an hour on that. And that means that when the UK next sends trainers out to Iraq to train the armed forces, they will be having to think about cultural heritage protection as part of their training at the armed forces. So, you know, it really does matter. So, turning now to this evening's lecture, we're going to be thinking about cultural heritage of a more intangible type, intellectual cultural heritage. So many of you know Professor Savage Smith already, and in fact I have known Emily for many a long year, as at first as when I was a student in Oxford, and since then as her long-serving and devoted and incredibly useful long time as a council member of the Institute. Professor Savage Smith has recently retired as Professor of the History of Islamic Science at the Oriental Institute and the University of Oxford. Now for some, retirement means putting your feet up and enjoying life. Emily's idea of enjoying life is to do, I wouldn't say even more work than usual, because Emily has always been prodigiously productive, but is continuing to research at a rate that puts the rest of us academics to shame. So she's got several ongoing projects that are related to what she'll be talking about tonight. So with Joseph Rappaport, the marvelously titled The Raised Up Roof and the Laid Down Bed, Stars, Maps and History in Medieval Islam. She's been looking at the treatment of cataracts in the medieval Islamic world. And she's also had a prestigious Wellcome Trust Senior Investigator Award, and I emphasize senior in the academic sense of brilliance rather than age there, for a project called A Literary History of Medicine, The Best Accounts of the Classes of Physicians, that's a book title, by Ibn Abi Eusebia, who died in 1270. So I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about medieval medicine and the people who practiced it over the next 50 minutes. So without further ado, I will hand you over to Professor Emily Savage-Smith. Thank you very much indeed, Emily.
Thank you very much, Eleanor, and for inviting me to give this year's Bonham Carter lecture. Now, I hope, can everyone hear me? Pretty well. Good. It is not really an exaggeration to say that in the 9th and 10th centuries, Iraq was at the cutting edge of surgery and medicine. Baghdad physicians were, in fact, the world leaders at that time. The illustration I've used to sort of advertise this talk, painted in Baghdad in 1224, I'll return to later on in the talk. Physicians in 9th century Baghdad, very wisely, went to some lengths to determine what earlier societies knew about medical care, and of course they made translations of Greek and Persian materials. Then using that as a base, they produced a rich and innovative medical literature of their own. Equally remarkable is the concern for public health and the delivery of medical care that was demonstrated by the Abbasid rulers of the day. The establishment, now let me see if I can, there we are. The establishment of an extensive system of hospitals, called the Imaristans at that time, was one of the great achievements of medieval Islamic society, and it began in Baghdad. Furthermore, it was in the context of these hospitals in Baghdad that the teaching of medicine at bedside was first introduced. The earliest hospital may have been built on the Karkaya Canal around the year 800 by the wazir of the Caliph Harun al-Rashid of 1001 Nights fame. Details, however, are unfortunately quite lacking about this. But in a little more than 100 years, there were five additional hospitals built in Baghdad, one established around 900, three between 914 and 920, and a fifth in the following decade. I hope that's showing all right. But the most important of the Baghdad hospitals was the Great Adudi Hospital, or Bimaristan, that was founded in 980 by the Buyid local ruler, Adud Adallah, after whom it was named. And when it was founded, it was reported that it had 25 physicians who made rounds every day. That is rather impressive. Now, all these hospitals in Baghdad derived their revenues from waqfs, or endowments, that were established by their founders. Now, there had, of course, been some earlier Byzantine poor and sick relief facilities offered by some Christian monasteries, which some historians have termed hospitals. But the structure and function of a medieval Islamic hospital differed substantially. The hospitals in the Islamic world were largely secular institutions, although they usually included a mosque or a place for prayer within the precincts. They were, almost all of them, open to male and female, rich and poor, Muslims and non-Muslims. Not only were the hospitals open to non-Muslims, as well as Muslims, but Christian, Jewish, and Muslim physicians worked together in the hospitals. We have, unfortunately, no real data about these institutions, no statistics on the patients, no data on what diseases were actually treated and how successful the treatments were. But we are fortunate in having preserved today a formulary, that's a book with recipes for compound remedies, a formulary that was compiled in the 11th century, but it was for use in the Aduri Hospital, and it was based on earlier formularies that were made in the 9th century and 10th centuries. And this formulary, which we do have now today, contains 292 drug recipes. And so it provides an important guide to the drug therapy of the day. But we still lack the statistical data that is so important to modern historians of medicine. The hospitals were for those who were traveling, or possibly without families, or the poor. It is unlikely that any truly wealthy person would have gone to a hospital unless they were taken ill while traveling and far from home. For ordinarily, all the medical needs of the wealthy and the powerful would have been administered in their home. We also have reports from the early 10th century that the good wazir, the one who founded a hospital in 920, on the earlier slide, that he gave instructions that medical care was to be provided to prisons on a daily basis, and that doctors were to travel with a traveling dispenser, were to visit villages in Lower Iraq. But we lack many concrete details about how this was actually carried out. The general health of individuals at this time, as well as the available medical care, depended upon their wealth and their rank, and whether they lived in an urban setting or whether they were in a rural setting. Just not unlike today for all of us. Now, amongst the court physicians in Baghdad at this time who taught in the hospitals, there are two names that loom very large indeed, for they wrote treatises that were to have an immense influence on the history of medicine. The first one, Abu Bakr Muhammad ibn Zakariya al-Razi, who died in 925, was one of the greatest medieval clinicians. He was born in the Iranian city of Rai, hence his name, Razi, but he worked a great deal in Baghdad. Rai at that time was an extremely important commercial center and actually deserves a good scholarly study today. But today it remains in a suburb of Tehran. Now, a story is related that Razi was instrumental in determining the location in Baghdad of the Aduri Hospital. For it is said that he chose the position of that hospital by hanging pieces of meat in various quarters of the city and finding out in which quarter there was least putrefaction. And then that was where it was built. Unfortunately, the Aduri Hospital, of course, was built in 980, and Razi died in 925. So the hospital that relates to that story must have been one of the earlier hospitals that I showed on an earlier slide. Many of his medical writings were translated into Latin, but two in particular had a great deal of influence. I'm showing here is the Latin version of his book of medicine dedicated to Mansur, which he dedicated in 903 to a governor of Rai. It was translated in the 12th century in Latin by Gerard of Cremona in Toledo, and it became one of the most widely read medieval European manuals. In the Renaissance, many editions of it were printed with commentaries by prominent physicians of the day, including the anatomist Vesalius, for example. And the Latin version here shows a portrait of Razi envisioned as a 15th century European, which is rather charming. Of course, in fact, we have no idea whatsoever what Razi looked like. Now, the second treatise by Razi is in English, the Comprehensive Book on Medicine. And it's, in fact, not a formal treatise at all. It's a large private notebook in which he placed extracts from the various treatises he was reading. And he also recorded clinical cases from his own experience. This quite large, commonplace book organized more like a filing cabinet than a formal treatise, was translated into Latin in 1279. It was printed in Latin in 1486, with repeated printings thereafter, extraordinarily influential treatise. We also have a collection of over 900 case histories of Razi that were recorded by his students while he was consulting with patients. These were never translated into Latin. They were unknown in Europe, but they provide a really extraordinary source for medical historians today. And throughout his writings, Razi displayed a really fundamental interest in therapeutics. He lacked the concern for classifying symptoms and this sort of thing that so occupy later writers on medicine. And on occasion, he criticized the great Greek physician Galen in matters of therapeutics. For example, he would say that his experience in the hospitals in Baghdad, in his experience, he had seen many more cases that did not follow Galen's description of fevers as did. Or in another instance, he said, regarding a urinary ailment, that while Galen had seen only three cases of this particular complaint, he had seen hundreds and consequently knew much more about them. So he was not overawed by authority. The other highly influential physician working in Baghdad hospitals was born shortly after the death of Razi. Ali ibn al-Abbas al-Majusi was born in the Iranian city of Ahwaz, but he spent his entire working life in Baghdad, where he served as physician to Adud Adala, the founder of the Adudi Hospital. Majusi was an outspoken advocate of bedside teaching of medicine. He dedicated his only composition, there's a couple of pages from it here, to Adud Adala. And this very treatise, was in fact the first Arabic medical treatise to be translated into Latin. Unfortunately, al-Majusi was not given credit for it. The translator, Constantine the African, who was a monk working at Monte Cassino, put his name on it and called it the Pantegne. So it really wasn't until the middle of the 12th century, when another translation was made by Stephen of Antioch, that Europe knew this treatise under Majusi's name, although they knew Majusi as Ali Abbas, that's what they called him. Both of these physicians, Razi and Majusi, had immense influence on the development of medicine in both the Arabic-speaking world and later in Europe. It has to be said, however, that in the translation, in these Latin translations, a great deal was lost or misunderstood during the translation process. And before leaving just the general topic of the importance, influence of Arabic medical encyclopedias on Europe, I have to mention the third major Arabic medical treatise that most people know, and that, of course, is the Canon of Medicine by Ibn Sina, died in 1037. Now, Ibn Sina, in fact, had no association at all with Baghdad. He was born in 980 in Central Asia. He traveled widely in the Eastern Islamic lands, never got as far as Baghdad. But he did, however, use the writings of Razi and Majusi in his own work. There are scholars, and I'm afraid I'm one of them, who have argued that Ibn Sina never actually practiced medicine. He was, no doubt, one of the greatest philosophers and logicians of Islam. But when it came to medicine, he compiled everything he had read about it, and he put it into a very large book, brilliantly organized under subject headings and subheadings and sub-subheadings. Its sheer size, as well as its title, suggesting, of course, canons and laws, it reinforced the impression that this should be regarded as the authoritative guide to medicine. It was translated into Latin by Gerard of Cremona again in the 12th century, a new Latin version made again in the 16th century. From 1500 to 1674, some 60 editions, that's 60 editions, of all a part of this canon of medicine were printed in Europe, mostly intended for use in university medical teaching. When, however, in a particularly dyspeptic mood, I often argue that the canon, in fact, was in fact a stultifying influence on the development of medical practice, and that it would have been better for the history of medicine if it had not had such a widespread influence. But now let us turn back to Baghdad and what medical care would have been available to someone in Baghdad in the 9th and 10th centuries. And I'm going to begin with the topic of women. We know there were women medics because Razi, amongst others, complained about the competition from women. We know that Razi's case histories, from his own case histories, that he himself attended to a number of female patients. But the role of women, both as givers of medical care and as patients, is essentially invisible and inaudible. Invisible and inaudible because not one single document or treatise written by a Muslim female medic or a Muslim midwife has been preserved from the Middle East before the 19th century. And this contrasts greatly with Europe, interestingly enough, because we have many medieval writings of midwives and female medics from Europe in the medieval period, but not from the Middle East. It's in the legal literature, actually, interestingly enough, where the midwives have some small voice because they can act as expert witnesses in court cases. So we have some evidence we can pull from that. The Arabic medical compendiums, however, all composed without exception by men, routinely contained extensive chapters on female ailments, especially obstetrics. The examples I've shown here, particularly on the right, you see they would frequently illustrate a vaginal speculum. You have a scalpel, two forceps, some hooks, and some lancets and knives. And according to the text, these were to be used for extracting a dead fetus. If a woman could not expel a dead fetus, her death was a certainty. So extreme measures were taken, or at least advocated. For we have no data on how frequently this would actually have been done. The idea being you're actually cutting up the fetus and extracting it in pieces. And in fact, in the 14th century, one Egyptian physician claims that this could not have been done, and he doesn't know anybody who would have done it. In any case, there's no evidence that forceps were ever used for live births. Now, there is a modern myth that cesarean sections were performed in the medieval Islamic world. And there are two sources for this myth. The first, and the one most frequently cited, is this miniature painting, it's on the left, made in 1307 to illustrate a world history written around 1000 AD by the great polymath Biruni. And this illustration shows the abdominal birth of Julius Caesar. And over the miniature, there's written in Arabic the statement, "The reason for this was that his mother died in labor while she was pregnant with him. So her abdomen was opened and he was taken out." Now, Biruni got this a bit wrong, since Julius Caesar's mother Aurelia outlived him. But nonetheless, the illustration has been used by modern historians to suggest that medieval Islamic physicians employed a post-mortem cesarean section. The one on the right-hand side is an example of a large number of illustrations that also support this myth. And these are miniatures illustrating the birth of the mythical hero Rustam from the Shahnameh, or King of the Book of Kings, written in Persian at the end of the 10th century. This particular illustration is from a copy now at St. Andrews University. It was made in 1605. And in this particular illustration, if you look closely, you'll see a baby sort of popping out of the side of the woman and falling into the hands of, either the physician or the father. It's not at all clear. In the course of the poem, it is said that the mother was given a drug to stupefy her and to dull any fear that she would have. Then it says that the operation was performed successfully, and that she had full recovery. However, this and all similar depictions of the abdominal birth of Rustam from a living woman are merely illustrations of a legend attributing to its hero a miraculous birth, which is a common attribute in antiquity for great men. There is no mention in the surgical literature of such a procedure ever being attempted, even as a postmortem effort to save the fetus. And none of these illustrations should be taken as evidence that cesarean sections were performed at this time. But they can serve as a cautionary tale, reminding modern readers that we should not read too much into an illustration, and we should not take them out of context. So having dispensed with this particular myth, let's turn to the Arabic medical literature written in Baghdad. Our knowledge of physicians and surgeons and what they were about in Baghdad is based not only on a very large number of Arabic medical treatises which they composed, but also on this remarkable history of physicians that Eleanor mentioned earlier. And this gives me an opportunity briefly to advertise our project in Oxford. You see the website. And we are doing an edition and translation of this remarkable treatise. When we look at what physicians and surgeons were doing, both looking at this history and looking at what they wrote and other documents we have to remember that there were no x-rays. There were no CT scans. There was no way of looking inside a body. There were no general anesthetics, and there were no reliable analgesics or painkillers. In the medical and biographical literature, everyday complaints are what really dominate. Hay fever, for example. Ghazi, whom I mentioned before, provided us with this first description of hay fever. He wrote, it's a small treatise, and he wrote it for a patient who suffered from this condition every spring when the roses were blooming. His patient was, in fact, the founder of the early school of cartography and geography known as the Balkhi School. And I put his name at the bottom. And I've actually illustrated it with two of his maps of Iraq, which are typical of the Balkhi School. And it's nice to have an example of we know the name of the patient, we know a lot about the patient, and in this case, we know a lot about the physician. And for Abaki, Razi recommended that his patient, reasonably enough, should avoid smelling things that were very odoriferous. Not only the roses that were blooming, but the herb basil, onions, leeks, garlics, and also he should avoid smelling wine. He also said that he ought not to sleep in damp rooms and he should not go around bareheaded in cold weather. This small treatise of Razi was never translated into Latin, which may explain why hay fever and related spring allergies, or allergic colds, as some people call them, is not mentioned in any European literature until 1884, in fact, when a Scottish physician by the name of Morrill Mackenzie first described hay fever and called it rose cold or rose fever. Now, pain management figures largely in our medical manuals. Very often, it was said that you didn't need any strong measures or drugs. A cold pack would do, a hot water bottle made from a sheep's bladder, massage, bathing, sound night's sleep. All of these were highly recommended for pain. They did know of a number of painkillers, opium, of course, being the most effective, they felt, and then mandrake, two other types of poppy, hemlock, black nightshade, and lettuce seeds, and they would often list these. And all of them act as ingredients in the compound remedies. Music therapy played a very important role, again, in treating pain, and treating patients in general, for that matter. And it was often said that compelling work, something that a person could become totally engrossed in doing, would alleviate pain. Now, gastrointestinal complaints are mentioned by everybody. The It's probably the single largest category of complaints for which recipes were being made in the Aduri Hospital, if our formulary is anything to go by. And there are numerous recipes for medicinal tablets and syrups for stomach pains, indigestion, gastric distress, diarrhea, so on. And I put up here a couple of examples. For indigestion, for example, you have apples, cooked apples this would be, added to honey. And another one, citron leaves that have been soaked in a very pure wine, it says, mixed with honey. And then you can, and added spices added to it. And another one is wine and honey with spices tied into a little bag and placed in the wine and honey and then put into a glass container set in the sun for 7 days. And then they say that the result will be very beneficial for your indigestion. For those recipes specified for diarrhea, they usually included a small quantity of opium and sometimes licorice. And if any of you are old enough to remember, there was a time when opium was very common in store-bought remedies for diarrhea. Now, toothache, you can imagine this was a very, very common complaint. On the left, I've put a quite typical recipe because it would have salt and honey, some kind of meal in it usually, laurel, mastic is again a kind of gum, frankincense, musk, camphor. These are all pounded together, kneaded, and then rubbed over the teeth. And it's worth noting that both salt and camphor are very commonly still used today for treating gums, or sore gums and bleeding gums. The extraction of teeth, of course, was a common topic. I've illustrated a couple dental forceps on the right-hand side there. There were also instruments, and those are some of the ones also on the right-hand side, in which you were to be used for extracting broken bits of bone that would have been left in the jaw when you extracted a tooth. Teeth that were loose or had been knocked out or even made artificially from ox bone could be connected to nearby teeth, sound teeth, by means of a gold or silver wire. Interestingly, generally, the health of the teeth seemed to have been very good. They had relatively little tooth decay compared to what we have today. Sore throats and coughs, very important element of their care. Drug recipes for the Aduri Hospital included a number of confections or lozenges made from licorice, honey, camphor, sugar candy, some binding agent, and flavorings or fruit juice. And again, this is quite similar to commercial cough drops today. However, they sometimes added opium or other varieties of poppy, which we tend not to put in our cough drops today. Infected tonsils, interestingly enough, were treated in a particularly interesting way because they were removed surgically. That is, there's extremely good evidence that the physicians of this time performed tonsillectomies. With the tongue immobilized by a tongue depressor, they would tell you, there was a hook would hold the swollen tonsil, and then they had a special little scissor-like instrument that they would describe that would cut the gland, hold it so that the patient didn't swallow it. Then afterwards, the patient was to gargle vinegar and water. Now, actually, such procedures are quite within the capabilities of the physician of that day. As recently as the early 20th century, itinerant removers of tonsils were practicing in the United States and in the UK, where they successfully removed the tonsils of children in their homes using virtually the same techniques with little or no anesthetic and no antisepsis. My father-in-law, for example, had his tonsils removed by an itinerant tonsillectomer in Colorado around 1905. While in the UK, one of the founding members of the Goon Show, Michael Benteen, had his tonsils removed in 1926 while in the kitchen of his parents' home in Folkestone. And although we have no statistical evidence to suggest that tonsillectomies were performed routinely, there's no reason to think that a physician at that time and place could not have successfully performed one using the procedures they described. Now, a tonsillectomy is really a procedure for removing growths. And most of the surgery was of this sort that didn't involve major incisions. Hemorrhoids falls under this. Hemorrhoids was apparently a very big problem at this time. And they frequently talk about that. And taking out embedded arrowheads, that again, you don't have a large incision for that. And then, of course, a lot of the literature devoted to setting broken or dislocated bones. Special reducing tables were employed to extend the limbs before you get them in the proper location and hold them. So I put up this rather humorous illustration from an Ottoman manuscript that is supposed to show a reducing table trying to realign a spinal dislocation. It's not very accurate. But an injured limb, once properly realigned, was bandaged and a splint applied. And what was essentially a cast was made of a cloth soaked in egg white and then wrapped tightly around the limb and allowed to dry. And there was also a lot of attention given to the repair of broken bones, which appears to also to have been a serious problem. And when it was necessary to close a wound, they sutured it, using either silk, linen, or wool, as had been traditionally done in Greece before them, or sometimes they would use animal gut. And this is at the point at which the earliest use we have of animal gut for sutures. Major or invasive surgery was scarcely ever attempted. Throughout the surgical writings, the physicians very sensibly display a concern about a real reluctance to undertake the most painful operations. Abdominal surgery was apparently not performed, with two possible exceptions. One is abdominal dropsy, which is an accumulation of fluid in the abdominal cavity. And in the literature, it said that it was treated by making an incision in the abdominal wall, then inserting a metal tube or cannula and drawing off the liquid. Sounds very reasonable. But physicians, in fact, would always go ahead and warn against doing this. You should not even try it unless the patient was very strong and all other treatments had failed. But it does not appear to have been done very frequently. The second one, of course, is the removal of bladder stones, which is an ancient technique. A calculus in the kidney or ureter, which is the duct carrying urine from the kidney to the bladder, could not have been treatable at this time. But a calculus impacted in the urethra, the duct carrying urine from the bladder, could be surgically removed. But how frequently and how successfully this would have been done, we don't know. And if you look at the case histories of Razi's, for example, there's no mention of any of this operation at all. A traumatic but not abdominal operation that was the subject of every manual, of course, was amputation. Gangrene was probably the most common reason for doing it, following multiple fractures. The amputation of lower limbs was performed, and all of the physicians warned against attempting any amputation above the knee or the elbow. The limb was ligatured before and above the site, and following the amputation, the site was cauterized, styptics applied. Now, interestingly, in all the discussions about amputation, there's no mention of painkillers or soporifics, even though in the popular mind, we associate that with an amputation. And as I mentioned, they were aware that substances such as opium were great painkillers or soporifics, but they're never mentioned in the connection with an amputation. And that, combined with the evident pain inflicted on the patient, recent medical historians have simply argued that an amputation of a limb on a living person was very rarely ever undertaken. I should add that amputation of a finger or a hand is very different. That is not as major an event. Presumably painful, however. Now, while we have little concrete evidence for amputations and that type of invasive surgery, we have a lot of evidence for eye surgery, and perhaps I should have warned a few people here on this slide, although it's a little blurry if you don't like looking at conditions. we, quite early on, specialized Arabic treatises were written on ophthalmology, and they already display some new techniques and, in fact, new diseases that were not described in the earlier Greek literature. Yohanna ibn Masawai wrote a treatise. He was a Syriac-speaking Christian court physician in Baghdad. He wrote a lot of treatises on many, many topics, from headaches and melancholy and poisons and leprosy and all sorts of things. But he wrote this treatise on eye diseases. And in it, he was the first to describe this condition, which is, we call it trachomatous pannus, sabal in Arabic. And it is a complication of trachoma. It was not described earlier. And he describes removing it surgically by using eye openers, he calls them, and they're illustrated at the top left, that little row of top right, the row of instruments up there. Tiny little hooks would lift these vessels. Pannus is a vascularization. That is, you're getting blood vessels coming from the membrane around the cornea, if you will, and coming onto it. They would lift the blood vessels with the hooks, and then using a very fine lancet, there's an illustration of one there, they would then cut them. This surgical technique, in English it's called peritomy, for the removal of trachomatous pannus, apparently devised for the first time in 9th century Baghdad, was revived in France in the mid-19th century, and it continued to be done exactly as he's describing it there until after the First World War. Slightly different techniques are used today. A pupil of Ibn Masawai was the famous translator Hanayn ibn Ishaq, another Syriac-speaking Christian physician, originally from southern Iraq. Hanayn worked in Baghdad as a physician, but better known today for his heroic translation efforts. And he was responsible, more than any other single person, for establishing the classical Arabic scientific and medical vocabulary. It's hugely important, actually. And he wrote several medical treatises himself, including 10 treatises on the eye. And he talks about trachoma and he talks about pannus, but this treatise is particularly remarkable because it's the earliest treatise we have from any language or culture that has eye diagrams. And it's a quite very early copy. I just note that the eye diagrams actually don't represent accurately what the text says. The text is better than the diagrams. In the next figure, it's the 10th century, is Ali ibn Isa al-Kahal. Kahal is oculist. And he wrote, an extremely influential treatise, a memorandum book for oculists. In his manual, he covers 130 eye ailments. He's concerned with the removal of cysts and styes, and I've illustrated two of his lancets that he uses for excising them. Some of this is rather gruesome, so I'll skip it. But anyway, he also spent a lot of time on trachoma and its many complications, just as Ibn Masawai had done. Trachoma was the major cause of blindness at this time and is still a major cause of blindness, actually, in parts of the Middle East today. It's a highly infectious granulation of the inside of the eyelid. And the trachoma itself was treated by pulling back the eyelid and scraping the inside of it, and here are two scrapers of a design that he recommended. And there were very intricate surgical procedures for dealing with some of the other complications, ingrown eyelashes, rolled in eyelids. And they did some quite complicated surgery in treating that. And he also described instruments and procedures for excising a condition called pterygium, which is not associated with trachoma. And here I give a little warning again. Look aside if you're a little bit queasy about illustrations. because I couldn't resist putting in a picture of what pterygium looks like. It is a triangular growth of the bulbar conjunctiva onto the front of the eye. And it's actually today is called surfer's eye because it's thought to be caused by excessive exposure to sunlight and dust, and apparently a lot of surfers are suffering from it today. But here again, it was removed surgically using much the same tools for pannus. The eye would have been held open with these eye openers at the top. The little hooks would have lifted this growth, and then a lancet or a small pair of scissors would be used to snip off the growth. We actually use identical procedures today, a little more hygienic and with anesthetic and a lot more antisepsis, but basically exactly the same procedures are used now. Such surgical procedures are intricate, painstaking, they cause a lot of pain, and yet they appear to have been done occasionally, if not routinely. Also, Ali ibn Isa, unique amongst all of these writers, when describing the surgery for pterygium, uses a word, tanwim, that has caused a lot of debate, because some scholars have argued that that meant to put the person to sleep into it. But others, that it merely meant for the patient to lie down. And it's an ambiguous word. Most scholars today argue that he simply meant, you know, have the patient lie down. But there are people today who still maintain that this is that use of that word means that this is the earliest example of a deep anesthesia. Now, he also described cataracts. In fact, almost every writer on eye diseases writing in Baghdad would talk about cataracts. This, again, another common cause of blindness, of course. And we know today that cataracts are caused by an opaque lens. But then they were thought to be due to a membrane that came down between the lens and the pupil. It doesn't make a great deal of difference in the way you treat it. The method he described, Ali ibn Isa, is known in English as couching. And it's an ancient technique, that it goes, there are records of it back in antiquity. It was apparently widely practiced. It consists of pushing the lens to one side out of the way rather than removing it. It was done by making a small incision at the edge of your cornea, just behind the edge of the cornea, what we call the limbus, and doing that with a lancet, taking the lancet out, putting in a couching needle, and I've given two examples of couching needles, into that opening, and then with the couching needle, you move it until it depresses the lens down into, there are filaments at the bottom of the eye, if you will, and the lens is to be pressed down that far. Ali ibn Isa gave instructions for tying the patient's hands before the operation, various ways to restrain him. He instructed that after the cataract needle had been inserted into the eye, the oculist should then address the patient with very encouraging and calming words to keep him calm. Following the operation, the patient was instructed to lie on his back for 7 days so that the cataract would not reascend. Now, in many societies, the practice of couching continued well into the 20th century. In India, there was a study of 550 cases of couching during the first decade of the 20th century. Of those, 38% had some vision restored, according to 10% had at least a third of their vision, and the rest were totally blind. We have very few studies that actually have been done in modern times of the success of couching. However, the technique employed by modern couchers in India and Senegal and various places is different from the technique of a medieval Baghdad physician. Because in the medieval period, they put the cataract needle, as you'll see in the illustration on the left there, behind, if you will, comes in from the side and pushes it down. Whereas a modern, 18th century on, culture of cataract goes straight in through the cornea of the eye. So it is a different technique, and it's very difficult to, that may account for what is actually a rather low success rate in India. But on the other hand, we had no statistics for the medieval period, so we can't actually make a meaningful comparison. But we have from an exact contemporary of Ali ibn Isa al-Kahal, named Amr ibn Ali al-Mosili, originally from Mosul, obviously, a very, very interesting description of a cataract needle. He, incidentally, moved. He left Iraq and did most of his work while in Egypt. In any case, in his manual, he only has 48 eye diseases, so it's a very small manual compared to others, but it contains a description of a hollow cataract needle that he asserted could be used to remove a cataract by suction. And this is intriguing modern physicians. He even presented two case histories in which he tells you how successful his technique was. It required a very large, much larger incision in the eye. Fairly thick hollow needle, and an assistant with an extraordinary lung capacity who would provide the suction to get it out. Later writers said that they have never seen anyone do this, but they continued to provide pictures of the hollow cataract needle, just in case you wanted to use it. So in this illustration, we have the standard round, hollow, not hollow, cataract needle on the right, and you have the hollow one on the left. And there was actually a 14th century Egyptian oculist named al-Shadhili who described two hollow cataract needles that he acquired in a market in Cairo, and he gave them to a friend who was traveling to Russia. And in Russia, according to the story, this man tried them on some poor woman who was left blind, and that was not very nice. So his friend came back from Russia, and al-Shadhili then proceeded to write a treatise telling you 10 reasons why you could not possibly remove a cataract by suction. So how successful was the surgery today, and how frequent? Well, as for the success, the lack of antisepsis and anesthesia were significant limitations on the surgery of the day. The precise extent to which infection was a factor is probably, it's just very uncertain at this distance. Only occasionally is it suggested that a patient be washed before any treatment. But after a treatment, the area was always cleansed with vinegar and water, or salt water, or wine mixed with oil of roses, or oil of roses by itself. All of these items have some antiseptic properties. And various aromatic herbs and resins, such as frankincense, myrrh, cassia, members of the laurel family, they were used in compound remedies that were used to treat a patient following surgery. And these also have some antiseptic properties, as do also the doses of lead and copper salts, alum, mercury, borax, which were all mixed with oils and resins to make various ointments. The efficacy of such items versus the numerous sources of infection is impossible to evaluate at this distance. With the exception of ophthalmological surgery, the vast majority of the operations would probably have followed accidents or battle wounds, in which case infection would already have been present. As for the readiness of people to undergo any of the operations I've described, I'm reminded of a story that was related concerning the physician Razi, about whom you've heard a great deal this evening. Razi refuses to submit himself to having his cataract couched. The 11th century polymath, Biruni, mentioned before, said that Razi's blindness from cataracts was caused by his studying too much, and by his fondness for beans. Now, the potential hazards of eating beans is the subject of another lecture entirely. But according to Biruni, Razi called an oculist who had been an associate of his when he was a student in Tabaristan. And the oculist came, and Razi asked him for a full description of the procedure for couching the cataract. The oculist gave him in great detail. But then Razi refused to have it couched, and he dismissed the oculist with the following words. Translation: I acknowledge that you are the most learned of oculists. You know, however, that this operation is not without pain, which the soul loathes, and long-drawn-out discomfort, which men find wearying. And perhaps my life may be cut short. The time of death may be near, and in that case, it's repugnant to someone like myself at the end of his days to choose pain and discomfort over repose. So go away with thanks for what you intended and endeavored to do. So according to Biruni, Razi died not long thereafter, in the year 925, at the age of 60. So in this anecdote, we see Razi, physician, clinician, active in Baghdad, dying at the age of 60, having grown blind with cataracts, which he declined to have treated by the very methods he advocated himself in his own medical writings. There's little doubt that during this early period, Baghdad did lead the world in medicine and surgery. In the very limited Latin and European vernacular literature of the same time period, surgery plays no role at all. And surgery with a knife was not a major part of Byzantine medicine either. Yet we do have this very rich literature composed by these physicians working in hospitals. I feel that there, given the limited evidence, it does suggest that there was a rather remarkable medical care being dispensed at this time. It's not modern medicine, but it's a quite remarkable medicine, particularly when you think about the lack of the technologies, the x-rays, the scans, the anesthesias, and so on, that we take so for granted today. In my view, the physicians of Abbasid Baghdad were practicing a reasonable, sensible medicine, that in many cases did help the patient. It's become customary amongst many writers to say that no medicine before the invention of aspirin could possibly have helped a patient, and I think that is unjust. I'm going to go quickly through this. I just wanted to mention one more writer, Ibn Butlan, who prepared we call it an almanac of health, really, in which he discusses in tabular format. He worked in Baghdad, by the way, about 260 different remedies and procedures for maintaining health. And this treatise is the last treatise, with a couple of minor exceptions. It's the last Arabic medieval treatise to be translated into Latin. And it had an enormous impact on Europe again, this particular almanac of health, or Taquim Sanitatis, as it was known in Latin. And actually, they're illustrated Latin copies and all. So I just mentioned this. Again, he's a Baghdad physician. He left Baghdad toward the end of his life and traveled in several places, became a monk, and ended up in a monastery in Antioch. As we all know, Baghdad's might and prosperity waned well before the Mongols sacked it in 1258. Devastating floods of the Tigris and Euphrates occurred in 1074, 1159, 1217, bitterly cold winters, crop failures, political instability. And for all these reasons, Baghdad declined as a major center of medicine and medical innovation. But new centers arose in Syria and Damascus in the 12th and 13th centuries. So I end with this picture with which I began. This a physician with two patients, it has usually been labeled, painted in Baghdad in 1224 by an unknown artist as an illustration to the Arabic translation of a treatise on medicinal substances by the Greek herbalist Dioscorides. The illustration has absolutely nothing to do with the surrounding text. As for what is going on in the painting, that is as great a puzzle as to why it is illustrating this text. We see a blindfolded patient sitting before a surgeon on the right. The patient gestures toward the physician, who in turn points to his own nose or upper mouth. On the table between them, we see small forceps and clamps or possibly scissors, which might suggest that tooth pulling might be contemplated. The bald and bearded figure at the left is the most curious, for he's seated on the ground, naked except for underpants, and has an extremely swollen stomach, suggesting a grotesquely large umbilical hernia or severe dropsy. He also gestures with one hand toward the physician, but with his left hand, he uses a fan to cool himself. So is he a patient awaiting surgery? Well, we don't know. The image occurs in the opening chapter of the fifth book of Dioscorides' treatise, where the text, in which this is illustrated, is embedded, the text describes the uses of the leaves, fruit, and juice of the cultivated grape. Thus, the topic of the text, the medicinal virtues of wine, if not this illustration, suggests that it's time to retire to the next room for refreshments.
Emily, thank you for the most enthralling talk. Wouldn't you agree? That was absolutely captivating. Before we do retire for wine or less alcoholic refreshments, I'm sure that you, like me, are full of questions. You want to know a little bit more. And Emily has very kindly agreed to take questions. So if anybody wants to ask anything, now is your chance. Lauren's coming around with the microphone. It does help if we can all hear.
You mentioned the lack of hygiene pre-operations.
Yes.
I was wondering what hygiene was like in the hospitals and whether it was sort of Florence Nightingale or worse.
Well, in fact, we don't know. All the hospitals had a large bath, you might say. And they, of course, they had separate quarters for the women and the men. But we don't know what the routine is. We just lack so many of the details that we would like to have to really know exactly what was being done in them. Like,
any other questions? Two questions, if I may. The first is your title says surgeons and physicians, but I mean you've been speaking as if, as it were, the surgery was done by the physician. So, does it make any sense to distinguish between surgeons and physicians in Baghdad?
That's a very good question. There isn't the clear-cut distinction that you would get in Europe later on with barber surgeons and physicians. There's not that kind of distinction. It gets a little tricky because Razi, for example, wrote all of these medical encyclopedias in which he discusses surgery in excruciating detail. And yet, when you see his case histories that his students recorded, he does no surgery. And it does suggest that there probably was someone who tended to do more surgery than, I mean, Razi may have just preferred to keep his hands cleaner, I don't know. Now, as far as the eye surgery, those were specialists. Those were, that's why they have the title, Kaha. They appear to be specialists from the early 9th century on.
And did you have a second question?
Yes, please? If I may, just a quick second question. The case histories you talked about, Razi's in particular, were they used for teaching purposes? I mean, it seems to us evident why people would write down case histories, but perhaps they were used for teaching, or were they used for advertising one's skill? Or
I shouldn't think advertising. They were recorded by their students, presumably because the students wanted them for teaching purposes. Now, within the Kitab al-Hawi, the comprehensive book on medicine that Razi put together from his reading notes, he there would intersperse his own notes, and that was more as a memorandum to himself that such a procedure had been done or not, or carry, or successful or not. So they're done for a different purpose. At no point, I mean, I don't know of any indication of purposely done for teaching, and certainly not for advertising. They advertised in other ways. They were not adverse to advertising, but not like that.
Thank you very much. There was a question at the front here, and then we'll come back.
Hello. You mentioned that after the fall of Baghdad in 1258, that the medical tradition kind of moved on to places like Damascus and places like that. I'd like you to perhaps enlighten us on what you know about. In fact, there's good evidence that the tradition in Mosul was continued quite actively for quite a long time. In fact, right into the 20th century, after the Ottomans had cleared them. I'd like perhaps if you could enlighten us more on that.
I'm not really certain I can. I'm not certain I heard the first part of the question.
Maybe I can repeat. What was happening in Mosul, basically? So, yes, if medicine dies out already before the Mongol conquest, and are things continuing up north in Mosul?
Yes, well, of course, certainly the medical, what we know of the medical care in Mosul and Baghdad in the 9th and 10th centuries, that did decline in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries. But then under Ottoman rule, later centuries, it changes, and people come back. We don't have a lot of evidence in terms of medicine as to what was going on in Mosul. We do know more about metalwork and woodworking and all kind of astronomy. We don't actually have, that I know of, much evidence for what other physicians were doing in Mosul at this time.
There is anecdotal evidence that the tradition continued, and especially Monstrate Abbey.
Well, it could well be. I can't elaborate on that.
So maybe you two should talk afterwards. And then there's the question over here. Is there anyone else in the queue at the moment? Good. Yes, one here. Thank you.
I think I probably expected to hear something about surgery of the skull, because I have it in mind that some ancient societies practiced surgery, trepanning, for example, and then more ambitious operations, for example, to relieve pressure in a skull fracture. Did you come across absolutely nothing along those lines?
No, absolutely not. No.
Are you surprised by that?
No, I'm not surprised by the question, because you get that in other times and places, but not in 19th and 10th century Baghdad. I'm sorry, I can't.
It was in Cordoba where they used to use the sign of the cross as a sign of taking the devil out of the mind.
Yes, well, that's much
yes,
later.
That's very different. Mm-hmm. So this lady here has a question, and then maybe we will adjourn at that point.
Yes, thank you very much for bringing all this to us and highlighting the advances of the medicine in Baghdad. But I want to know, there are any evidence or any studies to link the advances of medicine in Baghdad compared to India or China, and any sort of experience exchange between these
I apologize. I do have trouble with my hearing. You're asking, were there comparisons of this with what was going on in India or other places, Persia?
Just want to compare it with other civilization, like in India or in China. How do you compare the medical advances in Baghdad? And were there any exchanges between them?
Well, there were certain exchanges, of course, between what was then Persia and Baghdad and Iraq. India, the you have an earlier, slightly earlier period, early 9th century, where Indian medicine influences the emerging Arabic medicine. And that's a story in itself. The medicine that develops in the 9th and 10th century in Iraq then does not have any influence on the Indian medicine, which goes a different way. It's more Ayurvedic, it's less. They did do some surgery, you're exactly right, and they did do surgery for stones. Apparently, so you get into this business about cutting for stones, the bladder stones. That's very fraught with problems. How much were they doing and how much of this is a kind of tradition? Mm-hmm. But you don't have it going that way. Of course you have the treatises such as Razi and Majusi influencing, circulating in Central Asia and Iran, Baghdad, Persia, and then, of course, being incorporated into the great canon of medicine of Ibn Sina. So they drew on everything they could get their hands on, everything, from ancient Persia, from India, from Greece. But what they did with it, in certain ways, is something distinctive. But then it moves on. I don't know if that makes it any clearer to you.
No, that's super. Okay, one very last question.
It is just a comment that the basic principle of cataract surgery has not altered at all in the last 2,000 years. It remains sucking the content of the lens and injecting now a lens implant, that's all. But obviously different devices used. But still the same principle.
Thank you very much. Right, so I'd now like to invite Alistair Watson, who is a council member of the Institute and the Bahari curator of Arabic manuscripts at the Bodleian Libraries in Oxford, to express for us our deep gratitude. So Alistair, please do come along and give your vote.
Thank you.
Emily ended her talk drawing our attention to Dioscorides' book on wine. Being a teetotaler myself, but the 8th century poet of Baghdad, Abu Nuwas, famously was not. He was the drinking companion of Harun al-Rashid, the legendary Harun al-Rashid, and is known particularly for his khamriyat, or wine poems. As Emily has mentioned, wine was indeed used for medicinal purposes in medieval times, but Abu Nuwas speaks of wine as being not only his cure, but his malady at the same time. In his poetic answer to the master of the Mu'tazilites' rebuke for him drinking wine, and yes, rationalists, it seems, can also be killjoys, Abu Nuwas says, "Leave off reproaching me, for your reproaches just encourage me more. And let the wine itself, the illness, be my cure. The golden wine in whose precincts no sorrows can alight. If touched by rock, the rock is imbued with delight." Here Abu Nuwas seems to be attributing miraculous qualities to the wine, as if by mere touch it animates and gives life to inanimate objects. Now, I've had the pleasure of, and the honor and the privilege to have worked with Emily for a number of years now on more than one project, including the latest project which she alluded to in the course of her talk, the Literary History of Medicine Project. Our author, Ibn Abi al-Saybia, when he treats of the lives of the physicians, concentrates on the unusual, the amazing, the wondrous, and even, dare I say, the miraculous when it comes to medical care or cures. The work abounds with physicians who use their acumen and skill to bring about some innovative cure or another. This is all, of course, very entertaining and sensational and befits a literary history. What we've heard today, however, is a fascinating account of the more real, the commonplace, the workaday, the effective cures which were used in medieval Baghdad and elsewhere in the Islamic world, and which eventually also filtered through to the European, Western Europe. We've heard tonight of the Bimaristans, the hospitals of Baghdad. The word indicates a more eastern origin for the word. As many of the physicians we spoke about, or Emily spoke about, Muhammad ibn Zakaria Razi and al-Majusi also came from further east in Persia. We've heard tonight of couching and coterie, formularies and gastric troubles and toothache, tonsillectomies, hay fever. And we've had some myths dispelled, such as that of the practice of cesarean sections, and we've had Avicenna displaced from his exalted position. And we've been given a fascinating insight into the workaday surgery and medical practices of Baghdad. Please, would you all join me in congratulating and thanking Professor Savage Smith for her excellent lecture. Thank you.